Please help everyone, especially traveling this afternoon and evening, to get home safely. But again, we're so grateful for your love. We're grateful for your son, and he's definitely the one that brings us together today. It's in his great name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
John Oakes.
Okay. Well, I had to come running in. We almost didn't make it. Came out from our lunch, and there was Christian's car up on the tow truck. Whoops. Not much fun. Got his car. Well, anyway, it made it an expensive lunch, but we got here. It's good. Yeah. Bummer. Yeah, there you go. All right. So I'm going to do my third talk. I want to talk a little bit about the message that we've been doing. If you go to my website, the first two messages, including the one today, the recording is already there. PowerPoints, outlines, all that stuff, okay? And this one will be ready by tonight. So also, I mentioned our apologetic certificate series. They look like this. There's 10 of them. So basically, I don't know, 10 hours worth of video, outline, PowerPoint, syllabus if you want to take the course. There's tests, all those fun stuff, papers, things like that. And individual mentoring for me for each student. So that's that. All right, so we're going to change fairly significantly from the first two talks. The first two talks involve stuff that maybe I hadn't even thought about. I mean, you're essentially kind of being taught in some ways. This is more like presenting material you probably know a fair amount about already, but I think it's material that we could be using in our evangelism. So I want to talk about who is Jesus. And I think probably the people in this room probably know a fair amount about that already. But again, think of this as using this in material to help support the faith of your younger Christians and for evangelism. So who is the real Jesus? Some people say he's a sage, and that's not like Rosemary and Thyme. That's like a really smart guy, right? In fact, would you agree that Jesus was a sage, a very wise person? Some people would say he was a sage. In fact, that might be the most common idea about Jesus in the world. Some people would say he's a prophet. Now, could you be both a sage and a prophet? Yeah, that's a possibility. Some people say he's a liar, a deceiver. Now, could you be a sage and a liar? I don't think so. I don't think that's possible. Some people say he's crazy. In fact, as you know, some of his contemporaries said he was crazy. Other people said he was the Messiah, Son of Man. What's that mean? That's kind of an enigmatic thing. I mean, Ezekiel, Son of Man. Some people say God in the flesh. Others would say a legend, a mere myth. Our organization, Apologetics Research Society, arranged a debate on that topic with Robert Price and Doug Jacoby. And this guy says Jesus is not even an actual person. He's purely fiction. Some people would say he's a man. By that, they mean a mere man. And others would say he's an important religious leader amongst many. I would say probably the two most common ideas about Jesus today are number one and the last one. But I'm telling you that some of these are not logically consistent, okay? That he could be more than one of these, but some of these are certainly not possible. So let's talk about that. Before I do that, let's ask, what do some of the other great religious leaders of the world claim about themselves? What did Confucius claim about himself? Which one of those, or maybe more than one, which one was Confucius, even according to himself? The first one. Confucius was a wise person. Would you agree that Confucius was indeed a wise person? I think so. He's not overreaching there. Did he claim to work miracles, to be God, or any of those other things? No. All right, and yet a religion, sort of. It's not exactly a religion. Kind of a religion is based on his teachings. All right, what did Joseph Smith claim about himself? That's a fun one. All right. He claimed to be a prophet and to be a great teacher and that kind of thing, to be a spokesperson for God and one who delivers the word to God's people. All right, now, we may kind of have problems with that, but there you go. I've got a book on Mormonism out there if you're interested. Okay, what about Baha'u'llah, founder of Baha'i? He claimed to be a prophet, indeed the last and greatest of the prophets, and a teacher. Buddha. What did Buddha claim about himself? Did he claim to be a prophet? No, in fact, he was agnostic on the idea of God itself, so who had he been speaking for? What he claimed to be was a wise person. Moses. Moses claimed to be a prophet, a spokesperson for God. Muhammad, I don't know if you can read the comic there, says, "Thank you for your drawing, Billy, but now we have to kill you." He is a drawing of Muhammad, you know. But anyway, Muhammad claimed to be a spokesperson from God. He and Joseph Smith are shockingly similar in their story about themselves and their claims about themselves. He claimed to have a direct vision of Gabriel, and it's confusing what he actually had visions of. Muhammad, in the case of Muhammad, Gabriel. Okay, and then what about Jesus? What are some of the claims that Jesus made? You know, people say different roads. You know, we all want to get up here. You know, this is awesome. You know, in communion with this all God, he, she, it thing that, you know, that everybody sort of believes in. And the idea is, you know, you can take the Islam path, mysticism, Baha'i, Buddhism, Moses, whatever, Paul. I want to argue that is a ludicrous way of approaching this in view of who Jesus says he is. Because Jesus makes claims about himself that to try to do this last category, an important religious leader amongst many, it really makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So let's talk about that. Some people say he was a myth. And the idea that Jesus is a myth really doesn't work very well. I was talking to or communicating with a Hindu friend. He said, Jesus and Krishna, they're practically the same. And he was very offended that I said that Krishna was a myth. And I said, okay, so Krishna's not a myth. Tell me where he lived, when he lived, and tell me the name of some of his friends and you know, a few significant historical facts about Krishna. He said, okay, great, I'll get back with you. And he said, and he came back and said, yeah, Krishna lived kind of in this area in India in a city that doesn't actually exist. And he lived somewhere between 2000 BC and 100 AD, somewhere in that range. Okay, sounds like a myth to me, I don't know. I know the name of Jesus' adopted father, his mother, dozens of his best friends, three of his brothers. I know where he died, I know where he was born, I know how he died. I mean, you know, this is definitely not in the same category there. It doesn't make sense. I'm going to skip some of this stuff about the myths here. Did I do the wrong PowerPoint again? It's okay, because it doesn't matter, okay, because I'm now through that stuff and it's good. All right, so here's the question is, who does Jesus say that he is? Let's read John 5:39. See, in this talk, we're actually reading scriptures. This is fun. By the way, I've done a study along these lines with three different people in the last year who were baptized. It seemed to have helped. I think this is material you might want to use. As I noted earlier today, if you look at the sermons in the book of Acts, point number one, to a Jew, Jesus fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah and the messianic expectation. Jesus worked miracles showing that he has the authority to say what he's saying. He died and was raised. Same outline to the Gentiles, except they didn't stress the prophecies so much. So there you go. I think talking about what Jesus claimed, the miracles he worked, and the prophecies fulfilled is a great idea. Anyway, John 5:39. All right, let's see here. He said to the teachers of the law, the most educated people amongst the Jews, he said, "You study the scriptures diligently because you think that in them you have eternal life. These are the very scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me to have life." Now, this is pretty amazing. Jesus is getting in front of the most educated Jews, and he says, "You guys, you've been studying that Bible. You're totally immersed in it. I want to tell you something. The whole book is about me." I want Rhett to stand up. I want you to, make the equivalent claim about yourself. I would just want to see what the response of your friends is.
Right.
Yeah.
You read the Bible, and it's all about me.
All right, now do it again. No. Yeah. Now, your friends laughed at you, Rhett, because they don't think you're serious. So I want you to say it again that shows that you're serious, okay? Could you?
You know, Todd, doggone it. It's all about me.
All right. Now, thank you very much. The first time he said that, you laughed. Because you thought he was lying. Right? But he was lying in a joking way. The second time he said it, assuming we're being real here, you said, "He's not lying." So what did you say?
It's crazy.
But we do that.
Now, based on this one claim alone, we're already faced with having to make a choice here. He's definitely not merely a sage. And he's definitely not a great religious leader amongst other religious leaders, because by the claim that he made, he's not on the same level as those other guys. Either that or he doesn't belong in them at all. But then again, maybe Joseph Smith doesn't belong with them either, but that's another deal there. Okay, great. Now, let's see here. Let's go to John 6. Now, I realize these are familiar scriptures, but I'm kind of creating the scenario as if I'm speaking to a crowd amongst whom are many who are not believers. So I'm playing that role a little bit, so bear with me. And I might pick out somebody out there to get one of you to play a role that you may not want to play right now either, so we'll see. Okay. John 6. Let's actually read the part in verse 51. All right, Jesus said, "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world." Jesus said, if you eat of me, you will live forever. Did Moses say that?
Nope.
Bahula? Now, has anybody ever said something like that?
Nope.
Well, crazy people. If you spend time in the loony bin, we don't call it that, that's not politically correct. I've spent time there visiting friends, by the way, just so you know. And you'll hear stuff like that. And they'll look you in the eye, and they're not kidding. All right, let me see. Whose turn is it? Gordon, you made the mistake of looking me in the eye. All right, your turn.
Okay.
You're...
Okay.
All right. He's not going far. We'll let him go on. He's not going. Thank you, Gordon. He didn't go far enough. And I can't blame him. It just feels like blasphemy. It feels like blasphemy. Because it is blasphemy.
Yeah.
Yep. Unless you're crazy. And then it's just craziness. Jesus is not like any other religious leader. And whoever says so, they're just simply not thinking straight here. This doesn't make any sense. The idea that Muhammad and Jesus are somehow on some kind of equal footing is flat ludicrous. And for example, for a Muslim to say that Jesus is a prophet, you know, what do you mean he's a prophet? Well, if he's a prophet, then what he said is true. If what he said is true, then guess who's not a prophet?
Yes, exactly right.
Muhammad, I hope I can say that. Okay, now I'm looking for a volunteer on this one. By the way, this one's not blasphemy, but we're going to get a volunteer on this one. Okay, John 8:46. All right, yeah. This is going to be somebody whose spouse is also here. All right, thank you. You just got volunteered. I'm going to read it first. I'm going to read it. No, you can sit down for a minute. I'm going to read it first, and then I'm going to have you volunteer. Okay. All right, great. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? All right, go ahead. Now stand up, please.
Okay. Come on, Will.
Say it, Will. Seriously.
Can anyone here prove me guilty?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen a few of them.
His wife's thinking, yeah. On the way back from the restaurant, I told you to follow the GPS and you were prideful. Now, all kidding aside, Jesus stood up amongst a group of, I don't know, dozens, hundreds, I don't know, many of whom had known him for many, many years, and he says, can any of you prove me guilty of sin? Now imagine you're in that crowd. They're going, Oh, that's right. And so what did they do? Look at their response. Look at their response. Verse 46. I'll just read on. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I'm telling the truth, why don't you believe me? Whatever belongs to God, whoever belongs to God, hears what God says. The reason you do not hear is you do not belong to God. The Jews answered him, aren't you right in saying you're a Samaritan and demon-possessed? Now, a reasonable response to the question, can anybody prove me guilty of sin, is to say, yes, you did this and that happened. And amazingly, nobody did that. So they went to the only place they could go. Crazy. But one of the questions we need to ask is, well, what do crazy people do? They do crazy things. Now, you could argue some of the things Jesus did were crazy. Like saying to the Pharisees, you whitewashed tombs, you brood of vipers. You know, that's, but that's not a crazy crazy. That's the craziness of being right and calling people out as being a prophet. Now, what about John 8:58? We're not going to ask anybody to stand up on this one because what Brett was doing is what would immediately ensue, perhaps. But look at this one here. John 8:58. They say to Jesus in verse 57, about Abraham. He's talked about, all this. I knew what was going on before Abraham and all that. He says, you're not yet 50 years old, they said to him, and you have seen Abraham? Very truly I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. Not before Abraham was born, I was. No. Before Abraham was born, I am. What is he claiming? He's claiming to be the creator of the universe who preexisted the entire universe. And now, to say that Jesus is like some other religious leader is clearly, this is beyond, what are you talking about? You know, what's interesting to me is so many people in Texas, never mind elsewhere, you know, say, Jesus, yeah, Jesus is cool. But it doesn't really affect their lives all that much. I would wager that the people were there on this day, there were no kind of wishy-washy people, you know. There's the ones who want to kill him and the ones who want to give their entire lives to him. This thing that we experience, the people, as Jesus, you know, I go to church, you know, twice a year. You know, that's, yeah, I believe in Jesus. That didn't exist back then. I don't think so. Doesn't really make much sense. In fact, look at this. At this, they picked up stones to stone him. All right? And the way I understand it is what was going on in that day, those were the responses. You know, wanting to make him Lord or wanting to kill him. John 10, verse 30. We get the idea. We probably don't need to read anymore. I'm going to read two more anyway. John 10, verse 30. I'll start in verse 29. My Father has given them to me, talking about the apostles, is greater than all. No one can snatch them out of my hand. I and the Father are one. Now, that's kind of ambiguous. I and the Father are one. You know, maybe a Hindu sage could say that, you know. I and the Father, man, we're close. Yep. Either that, or what he's saying is, just so you know, I'm God. So which was he saying? I don't know. Let's read on. Let's see how those who heard him on that particular day thought he was saying. Again, his Jewish opponents picked up stones to stone him. He said to them, I've shown you many good works from the Father. For which of these do you stone me? We're not stoning you for any good work, they replied, but for blasphemy. Because you, a mere man, remember that was on the list, right? You, a mere man, claim to be God. Jesus says, no, you misunderstood. I'm not saying I'm God. I'm just saying me and God, we're kind of tight. Doesn't seem that way to me. How about you? My favorite is John 11. So I really like John 11, 25 and 26. Setting the scene here. I get the sense from reading the Gospels that Mary, Martha, and Lazarus may have been closer friends to Jesus even than some of the apostles. That's how close they were. I'm not sure exactly why, family, friends, I don't know exactly why. And Lazarus is very sick, so they send to Jesus, he's healed all these people he never met in his life, surely he's going to come home and heal his practically his best friend ever. Jesus, come on. He said, okay, you know, I'll get there, you know, at some point. It's cool. Everything's in control. Lazarus dies. 4 days later, Jesus shows up. And, of course, everything is in control, as we know. Yeah. All right. So, anyway, he has this discussion with Martha. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection of the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. Whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? And I believe Jesus is saying to everyone here, do you believe this? Jesus says, not I offer resurrection, which would be something else. Nobody ever said that. He didn't say I offer resurrection. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. Really, not that different from what he said when he said, I'm the bread of life. More or less the same thing. Now, Jesus had an interesting habit of making claims that put him in a league by himself, to say the least. But then working miracles that seemed to maybe bolster that claim. Right before he said, I'm the bread of life, what did he do? He made bread for about 10,000 people, men, women, and children, all right? So let's read on here a little bit. It goes down. All right, verse 38. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Now, he's been in there dead for 4 days in a fairly warm climate. What do you think what's happening to this body? Right. It's not a pretty picture. All right? It's smelling bad. certain liquids are oozing out. It's not a pretty picture. Okay? Jesus says, take away the stone. But Lord, Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, by this time there's a bad odor, for he has been in there 4 days. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank that you've heard me. I know you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that you may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and go. Jesus said, I'm the resurrection and the life. And he raised Lazarus dead for 4 days in front of hundreds of witnesses. And crazy person? Do crazy people raise somebody from the dead? Liar? Well, that's a pretty elaborate scheme there. Figure out how to work that one out. Now look at the response. And I want us to focus in on the response here. And I want everybody here, pretending this is a group of, including non-believers, to ask themselves, what's your response? Therefore, many of the Jews who'd come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. Well, no kidding. Gee, what a shock. I love how the Bible puts such a big thing in such few words, you know. Many people believed in him. Yeah. Raise Lazarus from the dead. What's interesting is the response of some other people. If you read on down. All right. If you read further down, basically, well, I'll go there. Let me see. Then the chief priest, verse 47, the chief priest and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they asked? Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away our temple and our nation. So they decided right then and there began the plot to kill Jesus. So there are two responses. To believe in him or to kill him. Now the ones who decide to kill him, is it because they didn't believe he raised Lazarus from the dead?
No.
No, it's because they believed he raised Lazarus from the dead. And they don't want to get on board.
Yep.
So they're thinking, we got one option. Kill him. And yet so many people say, yeah, Jesus, he's pretty swell. He's right up there with Mother Teresa and, Mahatma Gandhi. He's like that. I'm like, he's like that. I mean, the idea of Jesus is a nice person and I'm so glad and he's a great revolutionary and, you know, he's really stood up for women in his day. I mean, I guess he's all that. But the only way I can understand what he said is to conclude that he is the resurrection and the life. He is God in the flesh, a man who lived a perfect life. And I'm telling you, that's the only conclusion that makes any sense at all. So again, I ask, why did they decide to kill him? Because his life said, he needs to change. You know, it's like Peter, away from me, I'm a sinful man. So if you don't like his message, then hate Christianity, but don't say Jesus is a nice person, all right? Don't give me that. That doesn't make any sense at all. Those are the claims of Jesus. Was he crazy? Some people said he was. He didn't do crazy things. Was he a liar? Some people said he was, but he didn't do the things that liars do. Now, I want to talk about some reasons that I believe in Jesus. And some of those involve the accounts of what Jesus said from his followers. And, you know, as a skeptic, I'd say, well, you know, how do I really know? You know, that's what he said and did. Well, I could talk about that. There's a lot of reason to believe that. But I want to talk about why I believe in Jesus because of the prophecies he fulfilled. In Luke 24:44, he said, this is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. Just so you know, the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms are the three divisions of the Hebrew Bible. So what he's saying here is what we already saw in John 5, which is all the Old Testament is about me, and very specifically, the prophecies are about me. All right? Which we already read in John 5. All right, so let's play the skeptic's game a little bit. How do I really know these prophecies were written ahead of time? Maybe what it is basically, people said this happened, and they wrote these things later on to make it appear as if they were prophecies. And I'm seeing this skeptical look on Alan's face because he's heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he's aware, for example, Isaiah 53, we'll read in a minute, we have manuscripts of Isaiah 53 from 150 B.C. Wow. And add on top of that, the Septuagint translation into the Greek from the Hebrew is made around 250 B.C. And besides, whose Bible is this?
Jews.
It's the Jews' Bible. So do you think it would make any sense that we could convince the Jews to put false prophecies specific to Jesus into their scriptures? So this idea that these do not precede Jesus, this is ruled out by any level of common sense. In fact, Isaiah around 750 B.C., I'll give you some of the ages when we get there, okay? Some people might say, how do we know these things really happened? Well, we could talk about Tacitus, who reported how he died, where he died, when he died. We could talk about Josephus, a Jew. Tacitus was Roman. Josephus was Jewish. Josephus reported him being crucified in Jerusalem under Pontius Pilate. In fact, what I'm going to do is we're going to look at about eight or nine prophecies, and most of these prophecies involve things that are common knowledge of history, regardless of whether we trust these apostles, who, given that they were going to be killed for what they believed, didn't have a whole lot of motivation to lie. So these are historical facts. Number three, there's the Pontius inscription from Caesarea. They questioned whether Pontius Pilate was a real person. They found this inscription, Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea. Number three. Now, how do we know these are really actually prophecies about the Messiah? Maybe Jesus is just reading the Old Testament. It says jumped up and down. So Jesus, he jumped just like that. You know, it's like Nostradamus. You read Nostradamus, his prophecies are so vague, they could apply to JFK or I don't know, TBS or Donald Trump or whatever. All right, and here's the deal. Of the eight or nine prophecies we're going to read, all but one of them were held by Jews before Jesus' time to be prophecies about their Messiah. I'll tell you the one that's an exception. Here's another one, skeptic would say. Could Jesus, saying, all right, I want to kind of be this awesome, say I'm great, I'm going to be the Messiah. There are others that made these claims. So I read the Old Testament. It says, hey, ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. All right, check. You know, pay that guy off. You know, could he have done that? He could have. So here's the scenario. These things were written beforehand. These things really happened. But Jesus is a manipulator trying to sort of claim to be the Messiah. There's a few problems with that, because those prophecies involved you dying on a cross. They involve you being pierced. They involve you being despised and rejected. This is not a great plan, honestly. For a deceiver and liar who's trying to make a lot of money and get sex with as many women as he can, Joseph Smith and Muhammad, but that's not a great plan because it involves dying. That's not a great thing. So let's look at some of these prophecies. Now, I can go through these somewhat quickly if I wanted to with this group, because you know these prophecies. In fact, I just did this study with a guy a couple days ago. He'd been studying for months, and he was stuck. And we did this study, and after that, he's basically saying, I'm thinking I need to get baptized. So this is after somebody's already been through the studies, because the guys did a pretty good job. They were thorough. But the bottom line is I started asking him questions and I found out he wasn't sure he believed it all. It's like he accepted the idea of it. He was attracted to it, but he wasn't ready to commit to it. So I'm saying maybe it's because he doesn't believe in it. Imagine committing to something you don't believe in. Have we ever done that? Have we ever gotten people to be baptized and they didn't actually fully believe it? Yeah. So anyway, it worked for him. So there you go. So I'm not going to bother to actually read the scriptures. I think you know them. So it says in Isaiah 53, verse 3, despise and reject it, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. Now, is that a historical fact about Jesus? Absolutely. It's not. We don't know that just from the Gospels. Come on. Now, could Jesus, reading the Scripture, have arranged, because he wants to claim to be the Messiah now, to be despised and rejected? Could you do that? Sure. All right. Some people here, they can relate to Jesus. They've been despised and rejected as well. And I'm telling you, if you're going to walk into the leaders of the Jewish religion and tell them they're a bunch of a brood of vipers and stuff and snakes, you know, that might make that happen. All right. So we will grant this one to the skeptic. But then in verse 5, it says he was pierced for our transgressions. And if you don't know this, we can turn to John 19 and where he says these are the things he saw. He's reporting them as an eyewitness, because what happened was when they crucified the three, it was the eve of the Passover. So out of respect to the Jewish Passover, they wanted to end the crucifixions. The way to end a crucifixion is to break the bones of the legs, because then they can no longer push up and breathe. Within a few minutes of having your legs broken, you die, which, believe me, that is a merciful thing to do. They come to Jesus. He was already dead. Makes sense, since they beat him almost to death before that. So they don't break his legs, as prophesied in several places, including Psalm 22. Instead, they stab him in the side. Could Jesus have arranged to be pierced? I guess. I imagine him up there on the cross saying to the soldiers, hey guys, you know, you just crucified me, so you owe me one on this. Could you help me out here? So just trust me on this. And my friends will give you a little payment afterwards. Could you, Lord, pierce me with the spear after I die? That doesn't really make much sense. We could talk about being oppressed and afflicted, yet not opening his mouth. How about Micah 5:2? But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you're small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from ancient times. The Jews all recognize this as a prophecy of their Messiah. Now, where was Jesus born? Bethlehem. Now, wait a minute. There's two Bethlehems. Did you know that? There are two Bethlehems in Israel. The smaller of the two is Bethlehem Ephrathah. All right? Now, this is not a matter of the Christians making it up. This is where Jesus was born. Could Jesus, wanting to claim to be the Messiah, have arranged to get born in Bethlehem? Well, the answer is yes, if he's God. All right. And then there's the one in Isaiah 9, verse 1 and 6. Again, normally we'd be pulling our Bibles and reading it, but I'm going to keep going here. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he'll honor Galilee of the Gentiles by way of the sea along the Jordan. Now, if you read that scripture, it's not super obvious it's about the Messiah until you go down about five more verses. Where it says, to us a child is born. I recognize that one. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. This is a messianic passage. Now, it's interesting because Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and yet he wasn't raised there. Now, let's look at a map here. Here's where Zebulun is. Here's Naphtali. You know, they said to Jesus, no prophet could ever come from Galilee. Guess who they forgot? They forgot Jonah. Because Jonah is a prefigure of the Messiah. Jonah was the heart of that fish for 3 days and three nights. Like Jesus was in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. Jonah also willingly offered his life as a sacrifice to save the Gentiles. There's a lot of parallels there. It turns out his home is about 1.5 kilometers, about 1 mile from Nazareth. So now I'm going to show you a map of Palestine in Jesus' day. And look where Nazareth is. Right on the border of Zebulun and Naphtali. Now, in order to be the Messiah, you have to be born in Bethlehem, but you have to come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. How many people in any given time, what percentage are qualified here?
Very small.
Not very many. All right, great. Psalm 22. Now, like I said, I'm going to be reading about 8 different prophecies. Of those prophecies, all of them are clearly messianic, as in Jews themselves before Jesus was born said these are messianic. This is the one exception. Okay, so I'll tell you that. So maybe we're just reading this in. Let's see if that makes sense. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men have encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I don't know. What's that talking about? Pierced my hand. Does anything come to mind for you when you hear about, crucifixion? Is there any well-known person who got crucified? Is his name King David? Did you know that crucifixion wasn't invented until 300 B.C.? And crucifixion by piercing of hands and feet was invented by the Romans roughly 100 B.C., 900 years after these words were written. I like to imagine David writing this down, all right? Writing this awesome poem, God, you're awesome. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me in verse 1? I could see how he fell that way, all right? And then he says, all right, they've pierced my hands and my feet. All right, why did I just write that down? Did David ever have his hands and feet pierced? I don't think so. Could Jesus have arranged to be crucified? That's harder than you think. Because he was doing things that would make the Jews angry at him, but the Jews couldn't crucify anybody. So if he's going to arrange this, this is going to be quite a conspiracy here. A conspiracy to get killed. That's not, I don't know, that doesn't make sense. That makes no sense to me. All right, and then we read on, I can count all my bones. All right, and there are other prophecies parallel to this. And even in the Passover, God said, don't break any of those bones. A prophecy about this Passover lamb, the one we know as Jesus Christ. Because they broke the bones of everybody but Jesus, which is a fact. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Now, I'll admit that this detail we only have from the Gospels. So we have to accept the word of John who said this. But when they stripped the clothes off of Jesus, which did they do? This is confusing. Did they go one for you, one for you, for one for me? Or did they gamble? Which did they do? They did both. One for you, one for you, one for me. And when they came to the inner garment, they said, this is just too valuable. Let's gamble over it. Could Jesus have arranged this? Hey, guys, think about it. Think about it. That thing's worth, 50 denarii. Yeah, seriously. You're going to rip that thing? Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy thinking. Now, what's crazy thinking, in my opinion, is to say that this is not a prophecy about the Messiah that was fulfilled by Jesus. And, at some point, we have a cumulative case developing here. To conclude anything other than the obvious, it requires, I don't know how people's brain wiring would allow them to reach any other conclusion. And when Jesus said in Luke 24 that I'm fulfilling all the prophecies about the Messiah, it's looking good to me. Zechariah 11, 12, and 13. I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. Now let's read on. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. The handsome price at which they priced who? Me. So what is being said here is God is saying, I was sold for 30 pieces of silver. Does anybody happen to know, did you hear what Judas got as the betrayal price? 30. You're sure it's not 25? It's not like 35. Now, here's how it works. When you're lying, what you do is you give as few details as possible. All of us were teenagers at one time, so we're well trained at this, right? You give as few details as possible, so then when they start checking up, you can fill in the details and create a story. So if Jesus was not, in fact, betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, do you think the gospel writer would have said 30 pieces of silver? When the people were there, dozens of them were still alive. You know, this idea that the gospel was written much, much, much later. Therefore, you can't trust that. That doesn't make any sense at all. All right. For example, you were there in Boulder. Was it 30? How many years ago? 39 years ago? 39. All right. Do you think he's possibly confused that it was Tom Brown that was preaching? Do you think that detail could have slipped his mind? This idea that they're just sort of making up this stuff because it happened so much later. I mean, I can remember what happened 30 years ago. It's really not a problem. Now, I don't remember everything. But, you know, if a friend was killed right in front of me, I think I'd remember the price that was paid. So what did they do with the money? You know, I believe Judas's plan was to incite Jesus to rebellion to kind of throw off the Romans. It didn't work. He didn't get it. The kingdom is within. And so basically he's feels horrible. He says, here, I want to give the money back. They said, we're going to take it. He throws it on the ground. And they use the money to buy a potter's field. It's actually the field where they throw the shards of pottery. All right, last one. Daniel 9, 24 through 26. Right. Now, the context here is Daniel's reading the book of Jeremiah, probably Jeremiah 27, maybe Jeremiah 23. It's a prophecy that God would come and save his people from captivity after 70 years. So Daniel's reading, it's been about 68 years, so he says this prayer, hey, God, it's been, you know, let's go, come on, deliver. And this is his response. It says, 77s are decreed for you and your people in your holy city to finish transgression, put an end to sin, atone for wickedness, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up vision and prophecy, and anoint the most holy. No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. You can read on a little bit. Now, is this a messianic prophecy? Well, I think so. Delivered in the year 538 BC. It's dated. Let me see. To anoint the most holy. The word anoint is Messiah. I mean, if there was ever a messianic prophecy, it's the one that names him Messiah. To bring in everlasting righteousness, put an end to sin. So when's this going to happen? Well, from the time of the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, 77s. Now, that's 70 times 7, by the way, is 490. How do we know these are years? Well, first of all, the fulfillment says so. But the context of Daniel 9 is saying 70 years. And we know those were 70 literal years, 490 years. So when was this decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? Well, it turns out Cyrus said, go back to your city and rebuild the temple. Nothing about rebuilding the city, though, because that would make a place that they could defend and have rebellion. No, it was actually Artaxerxes. You can read it. It's in Ezra 7, 12 through 26, written hundreds of years before Christ. And it says, go back and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Nehemiah completed that task and the walls were built. The year is the seventh year of Artaxerxes, 458 B.C. All right, so let's subtract 490 from 458. We get negative 32. All right? Trust me on the math there. I'm a chemistry teacher, all right? I can do that one. All right, so that's 32 A.D., right? No, it's not 32 A.D. The reason is there was no year zero. All right? So 490 years from the issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem is actually 33 A.D. Now, by the way, the details, to be honest, the details here is after seven sevens and 62 sevens. So the prophecy actually predicts during the final week. In other words, somewhere between 26 and 33 A.D. In fact, smack in the middle, 30 A.D. So the prophecy is the Messiah would have to be killed to atone for sins in Jerusalem in roughly 30 A.D. Can you think of anybody who was born in Bethlehem and raised in Galilee who just so happened to have died in Jerusalem in about 30 A.D.? Could Jesus have arranged this? Well, the problem is you have to get born at the right time. I mean, I guess so. I guess so. So Jesus said in John 5 that the scriptures were written about him. And in Luke 24, he said, all the prophecies are about me. But in order to do that, you got to get born in Bethlehem. But you have to come from the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, somewhere in the close vicinity of Nazareth. You have to be despised and rejected. You have to be crucified and pierced, both. You have to be accused unto death and yet say nothing. You have to have your garments both divided and gambled over. Got to get betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. And you have to come to Jerusalem, die there, in about 30 A.D. Now, I have only one conclusion that makes even the slightest sliver of sense. Is that Jesus is the Messiah.
Yeah.
And if he's the Messiah, then he is God. And then what he said is true. And he is the resurrection and the life. And if we feed upon him, we will live even though we die. All those things are true. So who is Jesus? We can go back to the list. He's the Son of God.
Yeah.
He's God in the flesh. And all other conclusions are ruled out to anybody willing to even somewhat consider the possibility. Because, you know, you got to give me another option. You got to give me another explanation. I was in a jury last June. And it was, you know, there was this one person who wouldn't convict. She didn't understand the idea of beyond a reasonable doubt. The guy's DNA was on the gun. The guy's DNA was on the bullets in the gun. You know, that's what we're talking about. She said, I still have doubts. And we said to her, what is your doubt? Give me a scenario. Please, please, we begged her. Please give us a scenario by which the DNA got on the gun and on the bullets in the gun found at the robbery site. She couldn't give us one. All right, so we sent the letter to the judge, said it's hopeless. All right, but here's the point. Here's the point. Just like Jesus said, do you believe? What do you think about that? What is your response to this? Now we could talk about his miracles. I don't know. We're kind of running out of time here. You know, either Jesus worked miracles or he didn't. You know, those are your possibilities. And even the Jews who killed him called him a sorcerer. Even Josephus mentioned, maybe not that he worked miracles, but that people believed he worked miracles. And what about the resurrection? What about the resurrection? There's some facts here. First of all, it is a fact. As much of a fact as we have anything in the financial world, that Jesus was crucified in Nazareth under Pontius Pilate. That's a fact as much as it is that Tiberius ruled as emperor of Rome. It is a fact, I'm going to skip this information here, that from the very beginning, from its initial birth in Jerusalem in 30 AD, within weeks, or we could say maybe within months if you want to give some room for doubt, that the resurrection was preached, not only preached and believed. That is a historical fact. That even the enemies of Christianity, if they're pushed into a discussion, will have to agree. You cannot explain the nature of Christianity if that were not true. Fact that he was crucified, number one. Fact that the church at least believed he was in fact physically raised from the dead. Unmistakable. And fact number three, the tomb was empty. I mean, clearly it was empty. Because what were they doing in Jerusalem just a few days later? Saying he's alive. All right? So the Jews who put him in the tomb there, would, if his tomb was not empty, would have said, check it out, folks. Here's his body. And I believe there's a fourth fact that's worth mentioning, which is, in fact, he was alive. If you go to 1 Corinthians 15, Paul notes that Peter and John saw him alive, and the women saw him alive, and all the apostles saw him alive. And several times he appeared to them. And after that, he appeared to 500 eyewitnesses, almost all of whom are still alive. He's kind of saying, and also he says, and last of all, he appeared to me. He says, it's kind of like saying, if you don't believe me, just ask them. You know, Joseph Smith, in his Book of Mormon, he had three people who witnessed the golden tablets. Their names are there. Do you know that all three of them apostatized from Joseph Smith and his movement? All three of them did. And yet their names are still there right in the front of the Book of Mormon. They won't tell you that, but that's a fact. I mean, of these 500 eyewitnesses, how many of them later on said, well, you know, we're just kidding. And please don't kill me. Because all 500 of them lived under a death sentence, immediate death, because of their witness of the resurrection. So how many eyewitnesses do you need? How many eyewitnesses of the highest conceivable character who would give their life unflinchingly, how many would it take? So I'd argue, although the slide's not up on the screen, fact number four is he was alive. So if we know he was dead and we know he's alive, you kind of put one plus two together. You know the supposed explanations, the body stolen thing, and the fact that he kind of came to later on, shook himself off. You know, these things don't make any sense. So swoon theory, the mass hallucination theory. The bottom line is this: Jesus was raised from the dead. You know, if all you take away from that is this. That's really all you need. You know, all this other stuff, it almost doesn't matter. If Jesus was raised from the dead, what else do you need? Yeah. I don't know about you, but I, as a Christian, sometimes stuff comes up. You know, it's like, you know, I've read scriptures that kind of go, man, I don't get that one. I don't know, but Jesus was raised from the dead. I don't know. It kind of settles a lot of things for me. You know, if he was raised from the dead, as he said, then I don't know, it kind of clears up the picture, you know. What about, you know, this with the church, and what about this doctrine, and what about, this leader who said this? I don't know. But Jesus was raised from the dead. You know, that kind of, it solves a lot of the, it doesn't solve the problem, but it kind of clears my head. So I want to ask you, who do you believe Jesus is? Who do you believe he is? People have had a lot of proposals. Some people say sage, prophet, miracle worker, liar, crazy person, legend, myth, just a man. I would say, in light of the claims that he made about himself, we're almost there, in the light of the claims that Jesus made about himself, some of these are totally removed. Separate from evidence, they're removed. All right? Because if he said that he was, God in the flesh, that Before Abraham was born, I am. Some of these just don't really work very well. So my question is, who do you believe Jesus is? And then the second question is, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? Are you going to go home and say, well, that's nice. That's nice. Now, that doesn't make any sense, folks. Because he made some claims on our lives. You know, basically, he said that we need to follow him. And he did die for us, and he will live even if we die, if we believe in him and act on that belief. So, thank you very much. Do you have time for questions? Or?
Okay, so I feel two things at the same time. One, encourage.